hey, did I have a good night of sleep? You're probably going to think yes, no, or maybe.
When you get below 19, all the hairs on your back and neck stand up for the first time, and you get this like insane panic response, like exactly. Everyone does. When it comes to aerobic fitness, there's sort of two components to that. Your heart rate will be much, much higher
for the same back work. There's some apps now that can monitor your snoring and, you know, your some of, I think it's called sleep cycle. Like some data is better than no data. A lot of people that I meet are, if they're not naturally blessed, they're struggling with sleep on some
exercise, hydration, and nutrition. It's like, right, yeah, like you want to be top 10% yeah. instead of average, you know, or top 1%, you know, if you're Brian Johnson. There's some people that like to find mechanism and then wax lyrically on hypotheses on what might be happening, why it's happening. And for nerds like that, it's a super interesting talk about.
80% of the people out there, they don't really care how things work. Hello and welcome to yet another episode of the Shift with CJ podcast. Today, we have a special guest for you in the studio because our guest today is another biohacker. Now, you know that we have interviewed all kinds of people from all walks and frames of life, psychologists, scientists, athletes, but hardly have we interviewed a true biohacker. And this gets me really exciting because today's conversation is going to be between two biohackers. And in the studio today, I have James Jones, who is, this guy has so many, he wears multiple hats. He is a head coach at an elite biohacking facility right here in Dubai. He is a triathlete. He's done CrossFit. He's a performance coach. So many things. So everyone put your hands together for James Jones or JJ.
All right. Thank you for the intro. That was very generous of you. So that's very nice.
CJ and JJ. How is that? Sounds good, right?
Right. Yeah. It's got a good ring to it.
Yeah. So with a lot of the guests that I interview, most of the times I'm meeting them for the first time and then, you know, we jump into their backstory and in a conversation, I'm kind of like figuring out what this person has done. But James and me have so many conversations because we've like, he's trained me about a year and a half ago at this peak biohacking facility called Formation. And I remember the last thing I remember was that James put me on a bike and he literally put a mask on me and sucked the entire oxygen, or not the entire oxygen, but he depleted oxygen till I was almost about to faint. And then he's like, oh, now you can breathe. Remember that time?
Yeah. So I actually used you as one of the first guinea pigs to run through our altitude conditioning program. So that was designed to be a 6-week peaking program where we're trying to increase VO2 max as much as possible. Part of that protocol was altitude training. So I had you at the equivalent of, I think it was 10,000 feet. So about 15% oxygen. And we were getting your blood oxygen levels down to about 86. And there's a very interesting thing that happens with that. When you get below 90, all the hairs on your back of your neck stand up for the first time, and you get this like insane panic response, like exactly. Everyone does. And it is funny because like I tested it myself. I tested it a few times, but I know with you that was like a very visceral response.
I thought I was about to die. Like all the fear centers in my amygdala just stood up, and I was like, damn, this is what like real fear feels like. And I was like, is it over? And he's like, keep going. Oh man. But yeah, that was fun. So you mentioned a few words like VO2 max. Some people who are listening to this might be hearing this for the first time. So tell us, what is VO2 max and why would someone go and train at a high altitude or stimulate some kind of like a high altitude training response?
Okay, so VO2 max is it's milliliters of oxygen per minute per kilo of body weight that someone's body can process. So it's a measure of aerobic fitness. You get your VO2 max pretty close to max heart rate when your body is circulating as much blood as it can. That circulation of blood, the reason that we'd use altitude training, or reason athletes would go to altitude or we would simulate altitude training with a mask and a nitrogen generator, is that we're making the system work with less oxygen than it's used to. As a response to that, your body will produce a ferroprotein and it will increase your red blood cell count. So you can measure that with, you know, you can go actually get it checked, you know, in a clinic, you can get a blood test. You could even test hemoglobin with a finger prick test. And over time you'd see that go up. Normally for a male your age, we'd probably be looking about 16 millimoles per liter for hemoglobin.
Mm.
With altitude training, that can get up to 22. And that would be like, you know, very, very like rich, rich environment in order to transport the oxygen to the mitochondria.
And this gives you another competitive advantage because, you know, the original, like I used to see back in the day, a lot of UFC fighters, and they would go to the top of the mountain to train with less oxygen.
Yeah.
And they would use these high altitude training masks because once they come back down and when they have abundant amounts of oxygen, their ability to extract oxygen, or like you said, like their ability to extract or intake oxygen into the red blood cell gets enhanced so much that it becomes a piece of cake for them. So they're able to kind of like metabolize more oxygen, create more electrons. Am I right with this thought process?
Yeah, really, like when it comes to aerobic fitness, there's sort of two components to that. And we can break it down into oxygen utilization and oxygen transportation.
Okay.
Oxygen utilization would be the size and number of mitochondria available. That's the engines that actually produce the energy. Oxygen transportation is like stroke volume, maximum heart rate, and then the density of red blood cells. So you can sort of influence any one of those factors and you're going to have an increase in VO2 max. Obviously, with the altitude training, where we can both increase the size of the mitochondria that are already present because we're sort of stressing them out, making them become more efficient, making them become bigger. And then we're also working on the transport side of it, the oxygen transportation, because we're just literally getting more red blood cells. And working at that altitude, your heart rate will be much, much higher for the same amount of work that you've done. So you get a much larger physiologic response from similar work output.
So a lot of questions that I think people are having in their mind is that, is this safe?
It is safe, but it's very, very difficult. I would say unless you have a VO2 max over 42, maybe even 45, which is pretty fit, it's probably not worth, like the juice probably is not worth the squeeze. Like really, this is for people, I would say if you've got a VO2 max of like 50 and you need to get it to 60 as quickly as possible, you know, and it's like I have an event in 6 weeks, like that's where it sort of makes sense. You're not really getting huge lasting fitness benefits from this. It is sort of like putting a turbocharger on your system, you know what I mean? You're sort of overclocking it,
but you can't do it for all the time, right? Just leading like, up to an event or something very specific.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably the best way to use it. It's sort of like, you know, you've got the you've got your car prepared, and then a few weeks before the event, you slap a supercharger on it and sort of really max it out. It's pretty uncomfortable. It's not for everyone. And honestly, like in order to get to a healthy level of fitness, like there's no reason to slap a mask on your face and really push yourself to absolute max.
Neither for all the peak performance and people who really want to push to themselves. But like if you're looking at longevity, which is like a buzzword these days, or like just health and vitality, which is my second question to you. You, in one of your Instagram posts, which everyone please go and follow him, Do Biohacker. Amazing content. You mentioned about people losing VO2 max and strength above the age of 35.
Yeah.
You're right. So is it a natural decline that happens in all of us? And is there something that we can, like, is strength training and like a little bit of like endurance sessions, is that the answer? Or do you have any other specific protocol that people who don't have access to machines like this can get?
So I've actually, it started off as a functional age model. I've actually built it out into like literally a biological age model now. The idea was that for some basic metrics that you can take pretty cheaply and pretty easily, body composition, strength, flexibility, VO2 max, heart rate reserve, which would be your maximum heart rate minus your resting heart rate. I now build that up with some sort of health markers like blood pressure, uric acid, cholesterol, fasted blood glucose, and hemoglobin.
Okay. So the first part of this is something that you tested me on when I first came in, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I actually, we started, again, that was like early days. The model is way built out now.
Okay.
But getting back to the idea of this being like a functional age marker, is that there is a biological, like there's a biological age that most of these metrics peak. Some it's at 18, some it's at 25, some it's at 30. You know, there's different ages that these different metrics peak at. And then there's like, based on the data, there's like a average predictable rate of decline. And actually it's pretty simple. It tends to be about 1% per year.
Mm-hmm.
So flexibility peaks at about 21. And then it drops about 1% per year after that. Strength peaks about 30 and it drops about 1% per year. It also seems to correlate with testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
Then peaks like sort of late 20s and then starts drops.
Even earlier these days.
There's a lot of things going on with that. But the idea being is that if you know where you are with strength, flexibility, VO2 max, body composition, a few of these health markers, then you can make a pretty good functional guess of like, oh, like essentially I have the strength of a 31-year-old. I got the VO2 max of a 25-year-old. I have the flexibility of a 46-year-old. Right. And the truth is, I think that all of these markers are super important. Like, I don't think you can be fully healthy just focusing on one. Even if you have an amazing cardiovascular system, like the research has come out and it shows that those that do strength training, like resistance training and cardio, have a better relative risk reduction than people who just do either.
Okay.
Have you seen that study that came out a while ago?
No, I haven't, but I get what you're saying. So like basically people who go for not marathon training, but like people who go running on the weekend.
Yeah.
And if they think that gives them some kind of endorphins and that's giving them a little bit of workout, that's not the end all be all. It's probably good to mix and match. I see this every day with jiu-jitsu guys.
Yep.
So I'm still training jiu-jitsu. I started when I was at formation. And I see a lot of these guys pushing to their max every day, first thing in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you look at them, they're highly skilled, but most of them look out of shape. Because none of them go to the gym to train weights or they aren't doing anything else. They just come for jiu-jitsu. They're really good in the skill level, maybe a little bit on the endurance side of it as well. Because, you know, sometimes it's it mimics a high intensity interval training at times. So, I completely see this every day. Some guys they look at one specific sport, or for the people who do a lot of mobility and yoga, for example.
Yep.
So that's their primary focus. And then they lose out in probably some of the strength gains and some of the bone mass and bone mineral density.
Yeah, we see that. I think that sort of humans have sort of evolved to be generalists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that we're sort of designed to be well-rounded.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that if you leave any... if you leave any big gap in we're talking about physical performance now, but if you leave any big gap, that's a weak link in the chain, and it's the thing that's likely to hold you back when you're older. Because I say that these things decrease linearly, but there seems to be a part where if you have multiple lines decreasing linearly, it gets to a point where they start compounding. And if you were to look at a vitality curve, over time, essentially it drops linearly until it falls off a cliff.
Got it.
And I suppose as a biohacker, we're looking at, if you've got any kind of look at longevity, then you're like, wow, how do I push that cliff? I want to avoid the cliff. And exactly how high that vitality is sort of an individual choice. Some people, they might feel like they need to feel on top of the world every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And other people are happy to, you know, maybe a less performance focused, but almost everyone wants to avoid the cliff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or they want to prolong. Yeah. Because then that also brings us to this conversation of longevity, like I spoke earlier, because a lot of people now they're like, and I'm sure back in the day, we've both been talking about longevity and some of these, you know, protocols and some of the basic steps that you can take to get there. But you speak about this 5 or 7 years ago, everyone was laughing at you, and now it's become the buzzword. So everyone understands that it is possible, and probably there are these steps. Sometimes it doesn't even have to be complex supplements, and I want to go deep with you on that. Mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be that complicated. You could do simple things probably to kind of like avoid that cliff or like to prolong
in
just taking a deep dive into that cliff.
Yeah.
But in your daily, you know, interactions with your clients, and, you know, you also put together programs, not just for this country, but for other countries for formation
in New York,
right? Yeah. So is this the standard model that you see and you train people on? Like, okay, a person comes in, we need to look at their flexibility, their strength, their aerobic wellness, and only then we either make a program for them or we kind of like guide them on, hey, listen, this is the weak link, you've got to focus more here. So you know, you get to do flexibility or like some mobility work 10 minutes extra than the other person. Does it happen that way? Like, you look at an individualized approach?
Yeah, I'd say like the biohacking thing, I think at its core is individualized, either like strength, performance, medicine, like anything you can imagine. It's the idea that it starts with N equals one experiments, you know, and the more data you can get, the better. And so, with the clients that we work with, like pretty much everyone gets run through a full battery of tests. The more data we can get on them, the better, because it means that we're not having to guess, so we waste much less time. Also, like, a lot of times when people get the data back, they end up changing their minds over what they thought they wanted. You know, sometimes you have people come in and they're like, man, I just want to lose 5 kilos as fast as possible, and then it comes in and they're like, well, actually, now that I see it, like, I could probably get a little bit stronger too, and I probably need to lose a little bit of weight, but maybe I just need to focus on being healthy. You know, maybe the cholesterol is super high or something like that. And you're like, okay, like, we can work with that. And so, like, I don't write a program until we've done the testing, because I need to know where we're starting from.
So if someone was listening to this and like they're like, oh god, these guys are talking about all of these different markers, but I want to start, maybe they're not in Dubai, maybe they're in some other country, and they want to start somewhere basic. Like, they want to be like, I want to look at some of my data and then make sure that I incorporate some of these tips and hacks. Where does someone start off? Like, if someone's confused, where do they start off?
So I think that there's a, like, the more data, like, the core of biohacking is that we get data, we test, we get some data, we initiate a protocol, and then we retest, and hopefully it moves in the way that we want it to. But, you know, likewise, if it doesn't move in the way that we want it to, that's also useful data, because it means that we stop doing that thing, we change course. And that's like the essence of biohacking, is you're running experiments like constantly. And it's not just doing a healthy thing. Like, the core of biohacking is that, like, quantified self. And it's, I want to get some data, and then I'm going to use that data to implement positive changes in the direction that I want. So, like, a great place to start for most people, a lot of people already have something like an Apple Watch, a Whoop Strap, Garmin, Aura is great. And I would say, like, run an experiment that you think might work.
Okay.
And then be objective about it. You know, if you feel like, I want to improve my sleep, like, do something that you're going to think is going to improve your sleep, and then have a way to track it.
Yeah.
Right. It could be as simple as an Apple Watch. Like, a lot of people have these, or those, like, Huawei or Oppo, like, a lot of people are making these trackers now. And, like, are they as good as Aura or Whoop? Not really, but you can get usable data off them, and they're actually getting much better as more and more people using this, the data sets get larger and larger. Now we're probably getting like the integration of AI algorithms into these things, and like, the data over the next few years is going to be getting so much more accurate. You can make much better inferences from it at a much, much lower price point. Like, I think my fiance has got a Huawei watch, and like, I'm amazed at what it can do. And it was like a few hundred dirhams. It was like, it was like $50. Like, I can't believe that it can do that much. So I'd say get something to track yourself.
And so, like, for example, let's say someone gets an Apple Watch or a Huawei, there are also some apps now that can monitor your snoring and, you know, your some of, I think it's called Sleep Cycle, one of the apps.
Oh, yeah, that's just on your phone.
Yeah. So you can just keep your phone right next to your bed, and then it, I don't know how it does it, but there's a way where they kind of like track your sleep. I don't know how accurate it is. They say it's pretty accurate, but I would still say that some data is better than no data.
Because
when you try to think, hey, did I have a good night of sleep? You're probably going to think yes, no, or maybe, but that's not very objective. That's subjective to you. When you get objective data, you can look at a number, and then, you know, getting like a score of 70 is, it, you can try it. Like James is saying, you can try to go to a 72 or a 73 or a 75, but you need to know where you are at, and you need to see like a trend on what happens on certain days. Maybe on the weekends you're, you know, you're not sleeping at the right time, or you're eating too late, or you're drinking too late, or too much, or too less. How does coffee interact with you? So all of these things are things that you should be excited about. Like, as biohackers, that's one thing, right? We're excited about every time we have a new protocol, or, you know, we engage in having a new supplement. That's the first thing you're gonna notice. We'd be like, oh, how is this affecting the rest of my biology? So that's something that we're excited about. But if you're starting off, get something simple. I would say that sleep, and a lot of people that I meet are, if they're not naturally blessed, they're struggling with sleep on some way or
I'd say that's pretty commonplace to start. I'd say, like, if you can nail it down to a few basics, it's like sleep, sun exposure, exercise, hydration, and nutrition. You know, almost don't even bother with supplementation until you've got those things. If until you have a way to track those five things and make measurable improvements in them. And then even things like supplementation, you're really seeing how it impacts sleep and performance, or blood work, or something, right? And so
what about blood work? Is that is it advisable for someone to kind of get like a generic blood test and then compare their markers with what's on the lab test itself, because there is a average reference rate? What's your thoughts about like comparing your
I think from a health perspective, it's very, very valuable to at least yearly like get something go get a general blood work, like just go get some general blood work done, like see what your fasted glucose is, see what your cholesterol is, like see where your sex hormones are, like see where your, like, you know, things like C-reactive protein for inflammation, look at uric acid, that's a great sign for hydration, like just get some basic things. And like, is the range that the doctors give optimal? Like, for a biohacker, probably not. You might have to do a little bit of research there, and maybe you push yourself a little bit higher. So instead of aiming for the 50th percentile, maybe you're aiming for the, like,
idiot,
like the 10th percentile. Like, right. 10th. Yeah. Like, you want to be top 10% instead of average, you know, or top 1%. You know, if you're Brian Johnson, like, you can get that.
Brian Johnson, this is interesting. What's your thoughts on Brian Johnson and what he is doing? Are you supporter, or because you're a fan. Okay.
Yeah, what I find, like, in the biohacking world is that there's some people that like to find mechanism and then wax lyrically on hypotheses on what might be happening, why it's happening, and for nerds like us, that's super interesting to talk about. He's come at it not from like a philosopher's perspective, but from an engineering perspective. Like, he built PayPal or Venmo or something?
Yeah, he built something. He built two companies. One of his companies was really cool. I can't remember it right now. But he built two companies. One was in the mind space as well, where he connected... it was a mixture of psychology and like brain scanning equipment, lots of stuff. Okay. So he's pretty smart, this guy.
But he's taken things he's looking at it from an engineering perspective, and he actually doesn't care about mechanism. He's not thinking, he's not inferring, he's not like waxing lyrically, he's not playing games. He's going, like, he's almost just black boxing stuff, and he goes input, output.
Yeah.
We'll worry about what happens in the box later.
Yeah.
Right now we're on results. I add like NR or nicotinamide riboside, do my NAD plus levels go up? He's not so concerned about the mechanism or why that happens. He's like, I shift my my dinner back 1 hour, does my heart rate variability when I sleep go up? So he's just running these like black box experiments. And I think he built his protocol almost one at a time, like over like probably 3 years now. And he's just like, what is a better outcome? What is a better outcome? And obviously he's got like a team of doctors and scientists. I think he spends $2 million a year on it at this point.
That's incredible.
But like he's getting pretty close to optimal health markers, which is pretty amazing.
Considering the restrictions he has on himself, it's massive.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know Brian Johnson, we should have given people a bit of intro. Yeah. This guy is trying to reverse aging. Amazing guy on a mission, has a protocol called the Blueprint.
Yeah,
right?
Blueprint. Yep.
And he teaches people a lot of different things and is a really interesting character to look into. One of the other cool things that he, I mean, I like his black box approach because, to be honest, a lot, like 80% of the people out there, they don't really care how things work. They just want to see results.
Yeah.
And like, you're right. Like sometimes it's like, it's interesting for a conversation if you're with that right person that, hey, this is how it works. Most people are like, if it works, I'm going to try it.
Right. Like people don't care that the new iPhone has a better chip.
Yeah.
They care that it's the screen is smoother.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? They're like, I don't know. It's better. I didn't really care what's inside my iPhone. You know, like
you mentioned two terms or three terms rather that I want to go over. One is NAD and NR.
Yep.
So tell the listeners what NAD and NR is.
Okay. So these are supplements. They're sort of derivatives of niacin, which is B3, vitamin B3. And they increase NAD plus levels. So actually, interesting, like Brian Johnson has done the experiments. It shows that nicotinamide riboside, so that's NR, and nicotinamide mononucleotide, that's NMN. David Sinclair is a big fan of both of these. But he's showing that this will increase his NAD plus levels equally well. So pretty much just...
I'm a fan of NR.
Like, just go for which one's on sale at the time and from a reputable source.
Yeah, and I think like with NMN, it's a bit tricky because the compound by itself is so volatile that most of the factories, by the time it kind of like gets into the packaging, it's already exposed to so much of air that it's half of it is gone, unless you are taking it from a really, like, you know, you take it from, like you said, a reputable company that understands how sensitive this molecule is, so they're taking extra precautions to get it to the final consumer. And sometimes even when the final consumer gets it in like a powder form or something, most of it kind of like
I know that most of the experiments on like most of the animal studies use NR because it's cheaper, it's more readily available, and it's more stable. If both of them work equally well, then I'd probably go for the one that's got more backing. Even if one's slightly better, like they both work. Like, and so NAD plus is something, it's within your cells, is concerned with shuttling nutrients to the mitochondria. So as you get older, it's one of those things that declines. It's probably why we see, one of the reasons why we'll see a drop in VO2 max as we age. Going back to an earlier point, these levels start to drop. I don't think that like NR isn't the only way to raise this. It's like, so your body can produce can produce it from B3, and it's been really tightly correlated with doing cardiovascular exercise. So if you're eating, going back to the basics, like if you're eating a well-rounded diet and you're doing adequate cardiovascular exercise and probably some resistance training, so you've got
as well,
and probably some fasting, like stressing that out, you might increase the efficiency of that, and it'll increase it. So it's
I don't think a lot of people in like Sardinia or Okinawa or one of those places which are like a longevity hotspot, they're having any NR. They're just getting things from like natural sources, which their diets are in some places there is seaweed, in some places there is sheep's cheese, or you know, all of these things that can naturally boost some of those vitamins. But it's probably, if you are a longevity enthusiast, I think it's one of those things to take, right?
I definitely put it on the list. I would say that most of the real longevity drugs that seem to be promising, metformin, rapamycin.
Great. I want to know your take on that.
Trans resveratrol, NMN, spermidine, urolithin A, like carbon C60, but pretty much all of these fall into like one of three categories. It's so mimetic. So that means it sort of mimics something. So it's either an exercise mimetic, a fasting mimetic, or calorie restriction mimetic, to be more precise, or an antioxidant.
Got it.
Like everything sort of falls into one of those three categories. I don't know if you found anything that doesn't.
I haven't given it a thought that way. I'm just excited about like anything new that comes up, and like if it has the promise that, because right now there are so many supplements out there, and this is what I hear from a lot of people, like they're so confused on what to take because everything looks good, everything has good studies behind them, everything tends up to be like super expensive, and like every season there are the same people, whether it's you know, Dave Asprey, school guy, shout out to him, or Ben Greenfield, or whoever. They're just endorsing the same kind of products again and again. So sometimes you're just like, oh, is this really coming from a point of, you know, I've tried this product, it's amazing, I look into the science, or is it coming from the point of this company is now going on a roll and hiring all these influencers and everyone started to talk about that?
Could be that. I would say like from a health, like vitality, longevity perspective, also from a cost efficiency, like I don't think that just taking one of these, like it could be useful or it might not be, depending on what you want and what you're trying to do. I think where the biohacker, where you can approach this as a biohacker, is you can go and try and find a way to measure the effects of this, right? So like, you know, if you want to take melatonin for the antioxidant and sleep properties, like sleep is probably the most important thing that you can do to age well. So like measure your sleep. Does it actually improve your sleep, and does
that's
it make
where
you feel better?
From.
Right.
Like, track so it to hack it.
Track it to hack it. So start from there. I think a lot of these things sort of mimic other things. Like, you know, metformin sort of mimics fasting, you know, so like, so you could spend a lot of money on these things and get prescriptions and do these workarounds, or you could like fast sometimes, or at least eat on a on a calorie deficit until you're at a healthy body weight and have a healthy level of body fat, and then eat isocalorically, so eat to maintain that. Like the benefits of eating what you need is enormous. I think a lot of the complications with nutrition, people send nutrition products and all that, is really a misunderstanding, because most of the time, once you calorie equate things, a lot of the benefits or the evils of a specific food source or a specific nutrient or macronutrient sort of disappear. They get washed away. Like, your body's actually very good at converting things, and so like from a biohacker's point of view, it goes back to, you probably want to fill up deficiencies. So if you have, if you do a test and you have a vitamin D deficiency, and so you're like 20 millimolars, right, like boosting that up to 50 to be healthy, or if you're a biohacker, more like 70 65, right? And, you know, whether you do that by getting some sunlight or taking a vitamin D3 supplement, like, go do that and then get it retested. See if it worked. See that you actually did manage to raise those levels. And then, like, pay attention to things like heart rate variability, performance in the gym, stuff like that. Like, track that stuff as well. And you'll, if you're severely deficient in something, getting that to a non-deficient state
is already a win for you.
Huge, huge, huge return on investment. Like for whatever you're trying to get, for any kind of health market.
So you mentioned like some of the cornerstones of measuring things are your performance, your strength, your mobility or flexibility, your VO2 max. Would you keep HRV in that?
So like heart rate variability is pretty individual. What I've noticed, like some people just have really high heart rate variability. And then, you know, obviously when that dips down, like for them, like I've got very, very high heart rate variability. I've been tracking it since probably 2013.
What's your number?
Sorry. So mine, my baseline is about 110.
Nice.
So I've got a very, like, it's a weirdly
high. That's the max of, for a lot of people.
It's a really high baseline, and it can go higher than that. So for me, like, when it drops down to, like, 60, like, I feel tired. Like, but for a lot of people, 60 is like, wow, that is great. So
that gives them an 80 score on the Oura Ring.
Right. But these devices actually are, like, clever enough that they sort of know, after a while, they figure out your baseline, and then it knows for me, like, oh, like, you... You're stressed out today.
I'm not wearing the Whoop today, but like I've switched to the Whoop, and the Whoop has a 3-week period where it's only going to look for your baseline.
Yeah.
For the first 3 to 4 weeks, it doesn't tell you much, but it's only calculating and getting to your baseline because you're different than me. My average heart rate variability would be about 85 or 90.
Yeah.
But once I met a person on a flight and, you know, we just started a conversation because we were both wearing the Oura Ring at that time.
Okay.
And I was like, hey, what's your... I don't know if he was a biohacker, but I was, my first question is like, what's your HRV? And he's like, 220.
And I'm like, what?
What? He's like, yeah. And I'm like, come on. Like, I know about this stuff. Like, you know, I know about this stuff. And he's like, no, really? Come, let me show you. And then he goes over all of his Oura data. And the average was about 200 and 210. And I was like, what's your secret? Like, you know, and this guy looked like an average person. He's like, I used to have bad HRV and then I left my job and I was in a very sucky job. I hated my boss. I hated my life. And then I left it and moved to Africa. And since the time I took that, it was a really hard decision for me to do. And when I told my boss that, hey, I can't work here anymore, it was very emotional at that point. And right after that, my HRV shot up. So
that makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of the times we're telling or we're thinking that HRV is a result of, it is your autonomic nervous system, but like how well you're sleeping or what kind of a nutrition you have. But emotions play such a big role, which I think in the biohacking world, it's not really taken into consideration because we're all about like the tangible, the things that can we see, we can measure, and like, you know, things that we can upgrade and we can see it. But a lot of the times certain people have these emotional baggages. Maybe they've gone through past trauma or they've gone through situations which have like just declined their immunity at a certain point, declined their ANS function. So yeah, what's your take on like emotional fitness or emotional wellness?
So My degree was actually in psychology and in neuroscience.
Yeah.
That is my degree. And then I suppose from that, I really like the neuroscience aspect because we're trying to find ways to measure it.
Mm-hmm.
Like he found a way to measure his change, right? Like his heart rate variability shot up once he made that decision. So there are sort of ways to measure this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to just be completely abstract. And I think sort of grounding it like that is extremely valuable.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, like perception is reality for the person experiencing it. And so I think that a lot of chronic stress is perceived stress, not real stress.
Mm-hmm.
But it's real stress to the person.
For the person, yeah.
Just because I don't consider that important doesn't mean that they don't. And they're not experiencing the same hormonal cascade as you know, it's something that I would consider stressful. So it's, you know, it is very subjective, but I think the effects are real and they are measurable. So from a biohacker's standpoint, you know, that sort of makes sense, right?
Mm.
Like, you know, if we're looking at the difference between like kind of sympathetic, like broadly sympathetic or parasympathetic states. Like a lot of times when I'm thinking about making training programs and where a certain person is and that, like heart rate variability is a great way to sort of gauge or even just heart rate in general of, are you sympathetic or parasympathetic?
Mm-hmm.
And generally I think the rule is you need to be sympathetic sometimes. Because that's sort of a stress inoculation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to train really hard. You know, you need to go glycolytic. You maybe want to experience things like ice baths, stuff like that, because that short, compacted bit of stress actually lowers stress from the rest of the day.
What doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Right.
That's unfair.
But it's not just what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It comes with this point that if you raise stress levels, but they never drop back down, like that won't make you stronger because it's in that, that's in true. The parasympathetic, that rest and digest So out of the fight and flight, the sympathetic into the rest and digest, the parasympathetic, that's where we're going to make those adjustments that allow us to get stronger from the training. And getting a balance of the two can look very, very different for different people. So, you know, for someone who is super stressed out, they're not sleeping great, like their nutrition isn't on point, you know, maybe they've got some things in their life that aren't going the way that they want, and they're worried about that constantly, and they're not taking action on that. Like, perhaps for that person, like, you can't train them in the same with the same stressful way that you would a 19-year-old university athlete, right? It's just a completely different set of circumstances.
That's why individualization is so important. That's why the tests are so important.
Yeah.
So you can get like a baseline. I'm sure you get this quite a lot. You do a lot of ice baths. You jump into hyperbaric chambers, you do altitude training, and you do like lots of other things like triathlon this year. You've been pretty serious about triathlon. How's that going, by the way?
So I had a goal in like last year, and I set myself a challenge, like, can I do okay in a triathlon doing only 1 hour of training a week?
When you first told me this, I was like, what? How is this possible? And for the people who don't know about a triathlon training, it takes a lot of work, a lot of hours. You have to, if you're working at an office job, you have to go train in your lunch hours. It's a lot of work. And the first time he told me, it was like 1 hour, and then you were even planning to reduce it. I was like, how are you going to do it? And then he starts telling me about all of this biohacks. And I'm like, So yeah, go ahead. I just wanted to give that background so people have some context.
So I did that and I enjoyed it.
So you were training for 1 hour a day? 1 hour a week?
1 hour a week. So I was like, right, I haven't got a chance. I don't have time to build an aerobic base. I'm just going to max out aerobic power as hard as I can. Let's go for this. So just max heart rate stuff, like 4 or 5 times a week, get my heart rate max. Most sessions are like 7 to 15 minutes. Brick runs, I know, was the most important part. I know how to swim. So I was like, okay, well, this is the one piece that's going to be the hardest part, going from the bike to the run at a high heart rate. So I'm going to practice only the most difficult bit of a triathlon in the worst possible circumstances with blood flow restriction and altitude training. And anyway, that was a fun experiment and I did okay. And I think because of that, it was like super painful. And I was like, you know what? Like, maybe I can try not to just survive with the absolute minimum. Like, what if I actually try to do well at this? And so it was actually a few months after it, I was like, you know, actually, I really enjoyed that and I would like to compete in something. So I set myself the challenge to like podium this year. Dubai's actually got a very competitive triathlon scene.
Like, Dubai and Abu Dhabi are like quite a lot of people.
Yeah. There's, you know, these races have, you know, like sometimes 300-600 people showing up. Like, they're pretty big events and there's a lot of really, really, really good people, that take it seriously. And so I started, the first race was in October and I was like, well, practice it, like the said principle, you know, specific adaptation to imposed demands. I was like, well, if I want to do well at races, I should race a lot. And so I've done 9 this year, since October. And I started in my age category. So my goal was to get on the podium for my age category. I started at, I think about 12th place. So I was like, oh, like, okay, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
After a summer of training, I was pretty middle of the pack for the hour a week experiment. And I was like, okay, let's see what I can do. So, you know, focusing on it from like a scientific thing, I want to increase my aerobic base. I also want to increase my aerobic power. So I'm doing long stuff and I'm doing intervals. I'm doing pretty much 2 bikes, 2 swims, 2 runs a week, two strength training sessions. I'm lucky I have access to equipment so I can get my strength training sessions down to like 9 minutes. So that frees up a lot of time. I can just kind of squeeze that in while I'm at work. Anyway, so like doing this, I've like just kind of inch my way up the standings, and actually last weekend I managed to get 3rd in my age category. So I got on the podium, and so I sort of achieved my goal. And it was, yeah, it's just a fun experiment. I'm going to keep doing them.
It's addictive, I've heard.
Yeah, it's addictive. I think anything that you're doing, like when you can see yourself getting better every week and the things that you're applying are working, obviously there's just a lot of dopamine reward system in that. And so, you know, success begets success. Like, you know, starting at like middle of the pack and then moving further up and then, oh, like, you know, oh, I came, like, I managed to come eighth this time instead of 10th. Oh, I managed to get sixth. You know, oh, I managed to get fifth. Like, oh, I got fourth. Oh, wow, I was, like, fourth again. But I was 45 seconds off a podium. And, you know, you see yourself working towards that. And it's really, like I, you know, you can rationalize it and be like, oh, that's just dopamine. But it feels really good.
It feels safe. In the moment, like, yeah. All your pleasure pathways are on fire. Yeah. I think we should do another episode on just covering your training leading up to this triathlon, because a lot of people who are, if you want to give your secrets out, there are a lot of people that can learn from this, at least they're first timers.
Yeah.
They can, probably will do that the next time. We're almost reaching at the end of this podcast. Tell us, let's do some quick fiery things. Okay.
Okay.
One thing that you've learned this year that you wish you knew before in terms of health and performance.
It's been the triathlon journey, and it's the importance of doing some steady state cardio. I came out of the CrossFit world, and there was pretty much no steady state cardio. We were like, you just smash it for short durations, and that'll be good enough. And so being exposed to that and just seeing like the enormous improvement in like sleep quality, appetite regulation, like just general energy levels from doing the longer steady state cardio sessions. Like, I wish I'd known that 10 years ago.
It's cool. Yeah. If a triathlete reaches out to us and he wants to train with you, are you available for coaching, training, all of those things, or are you just training at Formation?
So I'm training at Formation. I'd say like I'm not an experienced like triathlete yet. You know, I'm doing only short course, so sprint and Olympic. There's very, very good like triathlon coaches. I actually hired one. Like right.
Every great coach needs a coach.
Yep. So I believe in coaching. So that is a DBT coaching in Dubai. So that's a.
So if you guys are looking for it, DBT coaching.
DBT coaching. So Gerard, he's the guy that runs that, is great. He sort of gave me like some little modifications that I think paid off. So that's good. I'd say I can help you with physiologic adaptation. You know,
cool, amazing. So that's it for today, James. Thank you so much for being on the show. We're gonna put your details on the show notes. And everybody, this is me, CJ, signing out of the Shift with CJ podcast. James, we're gonna have a conversation later behind the scenes as well. Take care, everybody.
Take care.